Hello, listeners, and thank you for tuning into Chats That Matter, the only podcast exclusively for employees of Cincinnati Bell Loop. That's CBTS, Onyx Canada, Hawaiian Telecom, and Cincinnati Bell. Since 2010, the company has invested more than $1 billion into our fiber networks in Greater Cincinnati and Hawaii. Our new partnership with Macquarie will provide the capital necessary to complete the fiber builds in both markets at an accelerated pace. Joining us today is Tom Simpson, Chief Operating Officer of Cincinnati Bell Inc., to discuss the fiber build plan and timeline in both markets. Tom will also provide a deeper look at the entertainment and communications business and the strategy going forward for Cincinnati Bell and Hawaiian Telecom. Tom, thanks for doing this. So this is really a follow-up from your blog you did recently for our newsletter, but really looking at the go-forward strategy for ENC. So to start with, can you tell us where are we now in terms of our fiber footprint in Cincinnati and Hawaii? And what's the time frame then to complete the fiber build in both of those territories?
That is the billion-dollar question. You know, I'm going to use some jokes in this podcast, so I'm going to apologize in advance to everybody. For a 150-year-old company and a 139-year-old company, respectively, you'd think we would know how many people live in the areas that we serve. And that is, with what you call plant records, has been a ongoing project for the last year and a half to identify exactly how many possible addresses are there in the Cincinnati and Hawaii areas. And why that matters is there are plenty of buildings and addresses in both areas, but not all of them are occupied. And when you look at what we've been reporting externally for several years, we report available doors, total doors in, or total addresses in the Cincinnati area at about 815,000 and about 448,000 in the Hawaii areas. And that's largely true. But I think one of the things I want to orient the folks that listen to this podcast, as well as our new board with Macquarie and the rest of the employees, is kind of two definitions. One definition is what we would call a network door. So that is a physical address that we pass with our fiber, or we might have installed fiber to it in the past decade, and what we would call a sellable door. And those are two simple terms, but they're different numbers. And you can think of the network door as the denominator and the sellable door as the enumerator, if you remember your fractions classes back in school. Why that matters is when we spend our money, our capital, on passing all of these addresses in our ILEC footprint, our Cincinnati and Hawaii ILEC footprints, the footprints that we've had for over 140 years, and not all of those doors are occupied, so that you can't, if a person doesn't live in that address or if it's a vacant lot, you still have to pass it with fiber because you can't just pick and choose. It's a linear thing. So you can really only capture the customers that are sellable doors. So orient with those two topics. And after a lot of this analysis and looking at the address records and the physical address data throughout our areas with a myriad of technologies, we actually have just north of 1 million network doors in our Cincinnati ILEC footprint. And just a little bit over 500,000 network doors in our Hawaii ILEC footprint. And of course, our ILEC footprint is that 140-year-old company since the days of copper. And why that matters is when we talk about the build and we talk about the percentages of what's left, you know, that denominator matters because we have to pass a chunk of those doors. What's largely still true is in Cincinnati, we're about 54, 55, might be as high as 57% fiber passed in the Cincinnati footprint. So, you know, it's 57% of the footprint. The network doors have been passed with fiber. And then there's a little bit of fallout because some vacancy in the city. And so that's the remainder of what we have to build in the Cincinnati area, the ILEC footprint. You know, it's still about 400,000 doors. That's including addresses that we had built out VDSL before. That's including addresses that were just DSL and underground. That's, you know, that runs the gamut. So there's still a lot of construction activity in the Cincinnati area. this calendar year and a lot of next calendar year, that construction activity is underground. And that's been arduous, as I'll talk about later. But you know, when you look at those things, and then you look at the remainder of what we have in Hawaii, same type of denominator, again, a little over 500,000 doors. We're about 38% by now fiber passed in the entire state of Hawaii. So there's a lot of doors to pass. When we talk about the length of time, I wish I could give you a straight answer, because this little thing called the global pandemic has hit us all. And this other little thing that everybody probably hears about in the news is certainly impacting us, and that supply chain. Everything from the fiber that we buy to the plastic boxes that we have to put in the ground or above the ground that this fiber hangs on, to the electronics that actively powers our network and actually lights up that fiber and pushes data around, the availability of those components is becoming stretched. To put it in perspective for folks, we just increased our purchasing of fiber. This is just the fiber assets, this is the stuff that we, again, hang on the road. We just increased that to 1 million feet per month of what we're purchasing. That translates to about 190 miles per month of fiber. And we maintain about a 90-day supply of that. We try to buy, we're actually buying a year plus in advance, but the fiber, the plants that produce this stuff, give it to us 90 days at a time. So that's kind of there are a lot of those things that are giving us constraints. Long-winded way of saying that at our current rate of production, we were targeting in Cincinnati about 75,000 new addresses this year. It looks like we're going to hit about 50,000. And in Hawaii, we were targeting 24,000. Looks like we're going to hit 28. Slightly different variances in what was available. The plan next year is we were effectively going to be doubling our output every successive year, and our goal was to be 100% done within 5 years.
Okay.
We have the money to do it.
Yeah.
We have a lot of the people to do it. We don't have all the people to do it. Our biggest limiting factor is supply chain. You know, when we build out our network, you know, and to get to that, if you did that math, you know, if we're 1 million network doors in Cincy and about 500,000 in Hawaii, that gets us to a point where we're our goal within 5 years is to have 1.5 million network doors passed with fiber. That includes businesses, about 30,000 businesses in Cincy, about 24,000 businesses in Hawaii, that's small, medium, all the way to enterprise businesses. Pretty big footprint.
Yeah.
That's certainly, you know, that's above 15, 20,000 miles of fiber being deployed in our footprints before we even talk about Dayton. Goals 5 years. I think we have the will.
Yeah.
It's 2022 is going to be a test to see how fast we can build.
Yeah.
With some of these constraints. Things look good right now, but as anybody, if you've tried buying anything online or made a major appliance purchase or buy a car or even buy groceries, you might find that sometimes some of these things aren't showing up at your door.
Yeah.
That's kind of our constraint at this moment.
You mentioned the supply chain. Do we also get impacted? Like, there's a lot of talk right now just generally about inflation and the cost of things going up. Does that enter the equation too? Or
it does. It does. There's a lot of... there's a lot of metrics that we track, and one of the metrics that we track with our entire build is what we call cost to pass. And there's a cost to pass, you know, again, this is you lay fiber past the street, and you know, you're averaging out that cost by the number of addresses that you pass in a neighborhood, and it gets aggregated up. That's our cost to pass. And that's the capital that we have to spend before we even install a customer. So we have in our long range plan with Macquarie, we have targets that to be financially viable from an investment standpoint, we have targets on our cost to pass. And what we're seeing is some of the materials costs are going up and some of our subcontractors costs are going up.
Mm.
So that we're actively discussing, you know, what can we do with either insourcing or changing the pace that we build to maintain our cost to pass. That's kind of the one the biggest variable that we have to be very, very adherent to is that cost to pass, because, you know, we have to generate a certain amount of EBITDA off of our build, and Macquarie has targets for us to set, and that's really the kind of our immovable parameter.
Are there going to be some areas where it's just not possible to build fiber and we'll have to find another solution, or are we all in on we're going to get fiber to everywhere we want to get it?
Super good question. Goal is 100% fiber. We had invested in a wireless spectrum technology, or wireless spectrum specifically called CBRS, and that spectrum is currently parked because the goal is, if we can't get 100% fiber passed, and because we are an ILEC, we have a carrier last resort obligation. So we have to be able to provide dial tone to a customer if they wish to purchase it, business or residential. And that's in all of our markets where we're an ILEC. And the first thrust of that CBRS spectrum is using that if we need it. Okay. Having said that, if when you read our announcements about Boone, Kenton, and Campbell County, Kentucky, the city or the county government is helping subsidize those builds, and that gets us to 100% fiber passed in very high cost to pass areas.
In terms of moving customers off the legacy network and onto the fiber network, from a financial perspective, is that like a clean break where we don't impact that? Or is there a financial impact that we have to manage?
Yeah. So if you're listening to this and, you know, we've talked about revenue and EBITDA since, you know, I've been with the company, it's a lot of what we measure and a lot of what we talk about in our quarterly leadership and all hands agendas. Ultimately, you know, the customers pay us and, you know, we service our customers and those revenues generate a certain amount of profits. And when you think about this with a copper asset, you have two factors. One is either due to legacy tariff pricing, a service on copper, such as a T1 service, is fairly high priced by today's standards. And because that asset is also so old, it has a lot of margin attributed to it. So when you add all these things up, either the legacy dial-up POTS lines or our legacy TDM products like T1s and PRIs and things like that, that still accounts for about 50% of our revenue, or 40% of our EBITDA, right? So you think a dollar in a T1, when we replace it with a fiber product, not only is the revenue lower, but the margin is lower because we've just invested all this capital in it. So yeah, there's absolutely a fairly material impact when we move customers from a legacy product to a fiber product. But having said that, you know, I don't know that anybody in the entire company can argue that a POTS line or a DSL line or a T1 is highly relevant.
And then I guess on the flip side is when you look at a new market like Dayton, is that like straight up new revenue that's coming in? Or how do you think about that?
The vast majority of it is, yeah. We had a little legacy presence in Dayton, just like we had there's a legacy presence in the neighbor islands in Hawaii. For the most part, the fiber that we're deploying in these areas is new revenue. So these are incremental dollars and incremental EBITDA and incremental customers that we are garnering. And when I talk about that 1.5 million network doors, that doesn't include Dayton or other areas that we might be prospecting for.
What will Dayton look like in the next couple of years? What's our high level plan there? How are we approaching that?
We will not build 100% of Dayton, but we are going to build a lot of it. And I can tell you at a high level, it is north of 200,000 addresses. And that includes some, when I think of Dayton, it's kind of like I think of Cincinnati. I live in Kentucky. That's not necessarily Cincinnati. Dayton has some surrounding areas in much of the same fashion.
One thing that in your newsletter message that I thought was interesting is you talked in more detail about the business segment. Mm-hmm. And I guess my perspective is always, I've kind of thought of the business segment in E&C as small business, which is not correct. What are the range of customers we support in that unit, and what are the services we offer them?
Yeah, it's interesting how, you know, CBTS has all of the marquee large enterprise businesses. Yeah. and also has all the snazzy technology that is all cutting edge. A lot of what ENC does in business is, you know, considered meat and potatoes, if you will. It's telecommunications. You know, we provide internet connectivity, we provide data connectivity, things like that. It's kind of like plumbing. Customers rely on it, and when you experience an outage, especially in business, that's a bad day for everybody involved. So the customers that we deal with, and when you look at it, it's actually almost 60% of ENC's revenue is actually business to business, business to enterprise.
Okay.
We run the gambit from, we have direct salespeople that sell to small, medium businesses. This is a coffee shop to a 2,000 person company throughout the Cincinnati and Hawaii areas. We run into those companies indirectly. We sell to Fortune 100 companies through our wholesale partners. So wholesale partners for us, if CBTS doesn't have a direct relationship with a company from a telecommunications standpoint, our ENC business unit would have a relationship with customers in our serving areas via other telecommunications providers. So a Lumen, CenturyLink, Verizon, AT&T, those customers are actually our customers that tend to sell nationally to a Home Depot, for example.
Okay.
We service Home Depot.
Okay.
Not nationally, but in our serving areas. But we're integrated part of the network. We service state and local government.
Yeah.
Every form of state and local government. We service the federal government.
Yeah.
So we carry telecommunications for everybody.
And then I think even we've done some stories in the past about like GE building a network within GE Aviation and things like that. Is that right? Are we doing some of those types of projects?
We do projects like that. We built a in-building wireless think LTE wireless solution for GE. That's a special project that we've done. It's not a huge portion of what we do, but it's things that we do. We just completed a network for Procter & Gamble. That was a wavelength network. So think optical networking between facilities. In the state of Hawaii, the Department of Transportation and Department of Education, we run large private networks for them, as well as all the healthcare providers.
So when you look at all this, you know, data points that come in, I think in your leadership meeting presentation and your blog, you spent some time just talking about really key metrics. ARPU was one of them. Strategic subs was one of them. So can you talk a little bit about those two things and, you know, why they're important, why you pay so much attention to those?
Sure. Well, I mean, it's the general health and well-being. You know, every customer counts. Because, you know, we don't have 2,000 large customers. We have several hundred thousand small customers and some large customers. You know, we do have a couple thousand large customers. The reason those metrics count is it gives us goals as we think about our long-range plan. We track to those and allows us to measure the health of how we're doing. So ARPU is a standard telecom term for average revenue per unit. Right. So we measure that the revenues, not all customers pay identical price, right? For a business customer or even a residential customer. We have promotional pricing, we have different package pricing, so not everybody pays the same price. But we tend to aggregate all those into an ARPU number. And that's an ARPU by product or an ARPU by PIC status. That's a whole podcast on those things if you wanted. And we try to measure those things because that tells us where we're at in both a median and an average range, again, against the health of our product status, you know, profitability, and as well as our long-range plan. So that's a very, very important measure. The other important measure, again, is when we start talking about, you know, we talked about kind of the mix of our revenue in legacy and strategic, and tracking the amount of strategic customers or penetration against our strategic product set. If I have 58% of Cincinnati covered in fiber and 38% covered in fiber in Hawaii, and we're spending billions of dollars to continue to invest in this fiber plant, we want to know how fast we fill up the capacity on that fiber plant and strategic customers. You know, our goal in both markets, really everywhere we build, our goal over time is to capture at least 50% of an available market with our fiber products.
I thought that was interesting, just because I think for somebody who never really looks at our financials or truly understands them, I think you might see a subscription number and maybe it's overall going down and you think that's bad. But then, you know, when you look at the strategic subscribers, they're going up. And ultimately, mm-hmm. that's what's really important.
It is. It is. That is what's important. And when you look at that's spot on. That's a good lead in. Thanks, Josh. When you look at we're losing some customers in some respects. We're losing legacy customers. Largely, we've outrun legacy decline in the consumer business in Cincinnati because, again, we're over half of our fiber plants built. We're a little bit over a third in Hawaii. That's an inventory issue. You know, it's when you think about a housing inventory and being able to sell or a car inventory and being able to sell. If you don't have enough inventory, you're turning down more customers and you're signing on. That's the nature of what we have. And again, as the network's built, if we're 100% past inside 5 years, then you see that net number go up a lot. The only thing that we will continue to see when we see trends is our legacy business in the B2B world. So we're talking T1s and business POTS lines and things like that. That'll continue to decline as those customers are moved on to fiber or they go through their own legacy refresh projects. And then the last one is, you know, you can consider it a value add is the video business.
Yeah.
You know, we've forced a decline in the amount of video subscribers that we want because we have to pass on a lot of our content costs to our consumer business and it trickles down and we can only pass on about 80-85% of our content increases. So if we pay $10 for content, we can really only pass on $8 because of the way video is marketed.
Is video here to stay for the short term, at least long term? What is
we'll probably be talking about video for the next 10 years.
Yeah,
it's we have you know a little under 200,000 video subs in both markets. That could grow as we grow Dayton. It's largely dependent upon the way our consumers who have the right to choose how they want to consume video. You know, you have your cord cutters and your streaming folks. And you have people that like to watch surfing FC Cincinnati or Fox Sports or Bally Sports now. And that's certainly your linear TV gig.
As we're doing all this, are we hiring and are we able to hire? Are we able to find talent? I know it's a tough job market from that respect. It's competitive.
It is a competitive job market. We're having no difficulties hiring at the moment. We pay well. I'd like to hope if you're listening to this, you agree that we have good culture. We our benefits are good. We're very stable. You know, it's a hardworking environment. As I look at it right now, we don't have difficulty. In some specific technical domains, that is a bit more challenging, but that's okay. That's okay. We're getting that as well.
So to sum up, as you think about the next couple of years, what keeps you up at night? And what excites you?
Pandemics keep me up at night. Supply chain keeps me up at night. Those are two topics that are very intertwined. COVID is still a very real threat. And, you know, I think the impact on both our employee base, the community, and supply chain is not over yet. I think our supply chain constraints are going to last for several years.
And then I guess on the other side, you've been here, I think, about 20 years.
A lifetime.
Had a lot of different roles. What do you think about in terms of when you think about the company now, what excites you?
Oh, my gosh. That's the reason, you know, that's the reason I was a big proponent of us entering into an agreement with Macquarie. You know, we went through the Brookfield saga. We went through that. That was years of hard work to get us to this point. What excites me is I look people in the eye inside the company, and this company, while we've grown CBTS, we've largely run in place inside of the rest of the company, and it's a 140-year-old company. What excites me about this is we now have a 140-year-old company that by investing in our fiber plant, finishing the network, expanding our network, we have people that have worked here 3 and 4 generations. we can continue to do that.
Yeah.
This is a business that when you think about, you think about a generational asset like that, and the fact that no matter where you are in our serving areas, you can get a ubiquitous product. That is something that is still denser than anywhere else in the nation. Some people might catch up, but when we talk about density, it changed the makeup of our company overall. You throw that in with the fact that we have a long-term financial sponsor in Macquarie that has a very long-term view, and they're enabling us to do things like start in earnest a sustainability program.
Yeah.
You know, our ESG and sustainability, we've done a great job with our diversity and inclusion and our employee resource groups, but being able to put meat behind sustainability is something that not only do we have an asset and a business that can last, you know, several more generations, but we can make our own dent on the planet in a positive way.
Well, Tom, this has been great. Thank you very much for your time and for doing this with us.
Well, thank you for having me.